Russia describes as unacceptable the presence of a British destroyer off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula. It warns of a harsh response to such provocation. The United Nations says conflict in northeast Nigeria led to the death of some 324,000 children under 5 between 2009 and 2021. The German Chancellor says that the EU needs a more unified approach on travel rules to ward off the spread of the more contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Bahram. Good to have you with us. Our top story, Russia saying it has delivered a strongly worded protest to Britain's ambassador over, quote, dangerous and provocative actions of a British warship in the Black Sea. In a statement, the Russian foreign ministry said it told the British envoy that London would be fully responsible for any consequences if a similar incident happened again. Russia says its forces fired warning shots at a British destroyer off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula, although Britain says no shots were fired. Moscow accused Britain of violating international law, saying it would harshly respond to such incidents. London says the warship was sailing in international waters. It has not entered Russian territorial waters.
I think it was wholly appropriate to use international waters. And by the way, the important point is that we don't recognise the Russian annexation of Crimea. This is part of a sovereign Ukrainian territory. It was entirely right that we should vindicate the law and pursue freedom of navigation in the way that we take the shortest route between two points, and that's what we did.
Boris Johnson says he does not believe that relations with Russia were at an historic low. He said he can remember times in his own lifetime when things have been far worse. Tensions have been on the rise between Moscow and the West since Crimea reunited with Russia following a referendum in 2014. Western countries deem the territory to be part of Ukraine and reject Russia's claim to the seas around it. Political commentator Bijanta Vasily believes that the UK intentionally provoked Russia to test the country's resolve in defending its territory. He says Moscow showed it is not afraid of Britain.
We have the account of the BBC journalist who was on board the ship, which is in itself a very interesting thing to notice, because normally there are soldiers on board of ships and not journalists. So why was this journalist there? Because they were trying to send a message. They wanted to traverse Russian Federation national waters, and they wanted to show that they can do so without fear of any harm. But the Russian Federation's navy destroyed this plan. They showed that if they do not immediately leave the territorial waters of the Russian Federation, they will be destroyed. And so they left. And they were, very failed in their mission to show that their impressive warships can make the Russians afraid. No, in effect, it was the opposite. They were so scared of the Russian military might that they left the waters and conceded the claim of the Russians have on their territory.
France joined Germany in urging the European Union to resume talks with Russia to resolve the dispute between the two sides.
Et donc nous définissons
We define the unity of Europeans in this dialogue with Russia. We are taking on this dialogue, which is necessary for the stability of the European continent, but demanding because we are not giving up any of our values or our interests. I think that this is the right method. We cannot remain in a purely reactive logic with regard to Russia.
Emmanuel Macron made a comment upon arrival at the European Council summit in Brussels, where relations with Russia will be discussed. Early in the day, the German Chancellor urged Brussels to establish direct contact with Moscow and Russian President. Angela Merkel said that talks must go on even if the bloc stands together against what she called provocations from Russia. Meantime, Ukraine slammed the proposal as a dangerous deviation from the EU sanctions policy. Moscow is at loggerheads with the West over a number of issues, including NATO's eastward expansion and the Ukraine conflict. The United Nations says that more than a decade of conflict in northeastern Nigeria resulted in the death of some 324,000 children under five at the end of 2020. In a report, the UN Development Program said an average of 170 people are dying every day in the war-torn region. Children under the age of five account for more than 90% of the mortalities. According to the report, insecurity has caused shortages of food, shelter, and clean water, which are taking a heavier toll on kids. Northeastern Nigeria plunged into chaos in 2009 when Boko Haram militants launched an insurgency that has since spread to neighboring countries. The war has spawned one of the world's worst humanitarian crises, leaving millions of people dependent on aid. Ethiopian military says an attack on a busy market in the war-torn Tigray region targeted rebel fighters, not civilians.
Our planes have eyes. They can identify who is a civilian and who is a combatant. It's the era of technology. It was a great success. Our heroic Air Force carried out a successful mission.
The military spokesman said that the operation targeted remnants of the region's dissident leadership and rebel fighters dressed in civilian clothes. Now that followed the UN call for an urgent investigation into the strike, which local officials say left at least 64 people dead and 180 injured. Witnesses and survivors have described explosions that caused widespread damage and casualties. In November, the government started an offensive to oust Tigray's dissident regional leadership, promising a swift victory. The conflict has triggered a humanitarian crisis that has pushed some 350,000 people on the brink of famine. Sudan has asked the UN Security Council to meet and discuss a dispute over a giant dam being built by Ethiopia on the Blue Nile. Ethiopia is pinning its hopes of economic development and power generation on that project. Mohamed Ali Fazada reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's Foreign Minister Mariam Sadiq al-Mahdi called on the Security Council to hold a session as soon as possible to discuss Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam and its impacts on the safety and security of millions of people. In a letter to the Council's head, al-Mahdi asked him to urge Ethiopia to stop the unilateral filling of the dam, he said, which exacerbates the disputes and poses a threat to regional and international peace and security. Earlier, Sudan's Minister of Irrigation and Water Resources, Yasser Abbas, warned that if second filling is completed without a binding legal agreement, Sudan's legal teams backed by international legal firms would file a lawsuit against the Italian company that is executing the projects and demand compensation from the Ethiopian government.
I think it is a good way forward if the three countries believe that this is there should be a win-win situation, because Ethiopians now, they brought into account the problem of how the quantities of water are going to be distributed between the two countries. We believe that this is not the right time. Now let us talk about the dam.
According to experts, Sudan wants Ethiopia to commit to legally binding agreements rather than guidelines on the amount of water retained and timetable for filling the reservoir. It also wants clarity on how disputes will be resolved in the future.
There is no way in front of Sudanese government unless to go to the international society, official international society, Security Council, and International Justice Court.
Sudan, Egypt, and Ethiopia have been locked in an inclusive talks for nearly a decade over filling operation of the massive dam, which broke ground in 2011. The Ethiopian government says that projects known as GERD is crucial for economic development and power generation, but Egypt fears it will imperil its water supply. Sudan is also concerned about the effect on its own water flows.
Tension between Sudan and Ethiopia escalated since Addis Ababa rejected international mediation. That's why Sudan selected UN Security Council to raise the issue of GERD. Mohamed Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
In other news, the German chancellor says the EU needs a more unified approach on travel rules to ward off the spread of the more contagious Delta variant of COVID-19.
We are obviously concerned about the Delta variant. I will lobby for a more coordinated approach, especially with regard to entries from regions where virus variants abound.
Angela Merkel warned that Europe is in a risky situation and countries need to remain vigilant. She noted the issue will be the main topic of a Thursday meeting with EU leaders in Brussels. Meantime, Russia has logged a record number of COVID cases and deaths. The Delta variant is sweeping across the country. On Thursday, Russia reported some 200,000 infections and 560 deaths, the highest figure since January. Officials say the new strain accounts for more than 90% of new infections in Moscow. Meantime, India has reported 54,000 new coronavirus infections, pushing the caseload there to 30 million. Health Ministry also reported some 1,300 new deaths, and that takes the fatalities to nearly 400,000. India witnessed a staggering surge in April and May, causing a nationwide health crisis. Daily infections reached their peak of more than 400,000 last month. The number of cases has been on the decline in the past couple of weeks. That after authorities implemented strict lockdown measures to curb the pandemic. Mass vaccine rollouts also helped India get out of the crisis.
It's the world's second most populous nation, and the figures of COVID-19 infection cases are rising on a daily basis. The cities are bustling as the country is picking up pace as the world's fastest growing major economies. But in all this hustle-bustle and race of survival, an important aspect of life is on stake, and that is mental health. The second wave of COVID-19 has altered the lifestyle of millions across India who now are struggling in silence. Reports suggest more than 70% of those in the age group of 18 to 24 are suffering from some form of depression. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has ignited the crisis further, as many are facing financial and social hardships. According to psychological experts, economic and social pressures combined with a lack of appropriate mental health facilities is a major reason behind this new epidemic, which has now started exploding due to the coronavirus pandemic. Based on reports, the economic cost of mental illness in India is expected to be more than $1 trillion by 2030.
COVID-19 has impacted a lot. A lot means you can say everyone, almost everyone, because one or the other way, everyone has been affected. Whether it's you know, the infection has caused, or you know, the mental health, or the other ways, because the businesses has shut down.
Health experts say all disorders are linked to a fast-paced lifestyle, stress, complexities of living, breakdown of support systems, and challenges of economic instability. They say the COVID pandemic has added fuel to the fire with depression, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, psychotic disorders, and substance abuse being common in most people.
One must go for yoga daily. Yoga, you have to do proper yoga. Then breathing exercises are there. They have to do at least half an hour to 1 hour so that the blood circulation towards brain increases.
COVID-19 lockdowns impacted people from all walks of life and age groups. Now they're finding it hard to deal with consequences of the pandemic-induced lockdowns. Many turn to drugs and alcohol, while others prefer religious therapies and yoga. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
And Afghanistan officials say that at least 28 civilians have been killed this week in Taliban offensive in the northern province of Kunduz. Local hospital officials say 290 civilians were also wounded in the past 3 days. Children, women, and elderly people make up the majority of the casualties. Northern Afghanistan has been the scene of heavy fighting between government forces and the Taliban recently, the militants trying to seize control of key cities in the region. Officials say that the Doha peace talks between Kabul and the Taliban have largely stalled. There have been meetings in recent days, however, and the Taliban say they are committed to negotiations. Israel has advanced plans for 31 new settlement construction projects in the occupied West Bank, and this is the first construction approval under the new cabinet. The plans include a shopping center, a school, and a number of infrastructure projects. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem Oblast. Tel Aviv has recently stepped up settlement activities backed by the U.S. and in defiance of UN Security Council Resolution 2334. All those settlements are illegal under international law. Activist and political commentator Jamal Joma says that Tel Aviv is committing crimes with impunity due to the support it receives from the U.S. and some Western countries.
All their aims and their main goals, and they are in race for stealing the Palestinian land, cementing the apartheid system that they are putting in the West Bank. They are putting in danger the Palestinian future to be blocked in this apartheid system, while their resources is being taken and confiscated in the land that they are building settlements on, in what so-called Area C, 62% of the West Bank. All the Palestinian resources is there. We are practicing, and we are, the whole world also sees very well that Israel is an apartheid colonial state. Israel is a criminal state that they are confiscating the Palestinian rights, confiscating the Palestinian future. In this context, I think the international law looks like doesn't applicable to Israel. Like, and Israel has been immune since 1948 from all the crimes that they are committing, and there is no consequences whatsoever. And this is clearly because they have this support, unconditional support, regardless what they can do, what they can commit crimes from the United States, from the West. And this should be ended.
Now, more censorship by the United States toward media in Iran and others in West Asia. Press TV's website has been among dozens of others that have been seized by Washington in an unprecedented attack on free speech.
The United States has launched a wide-scale cyber crackdown on the websites of major news networks, mainly based in West Asia. In what appears to have been a coordinated operation, the domain for the websites was seized at a similar time late Tuesday night. Viewers visiting the sites have been met with the same notice from the U.S. Department of Commerce and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which reads, "This website has been seized. The domain has been seized by the United States government." The alleged legislation stated in the notice is too vague and wide to pinpoint exactly why the sites have been targeted. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, a total of 36 websites have been seized. Among the most prominent websites of news networks that have been targeted are Iranian-based news channels Press TV, Al Alam, and Al Kothar. In Yemen, the popular Al Masira news outlet that has been documenting Saudi Arabia's war on the country, along with other regional developments, has also been seized. Palestine Today is another, and the website of Lu'lu'a TV, an independent Bahraini news channel, was also captured. Washington took control of sites linked to news channels based in Iraq, too. These are mainly associated with the country's most important anti-terrorism security force, the Popular Mobilization Forces, the same branch of the Iraqi armed forces that spearheaded their victory against Daesh terrorists from 2014 to 2017. This has left many asking, where is America's so-called free speech and democracy?
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's episode, we're discussing The Reagan Show, directed by Pacho Velez and Sierra Passengill. And joining me in this episode are Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Neil Faulkner, who is a historian, writer, and author, and has a new edition of his book coming out soon, which is called A Radical History of the World. Now, made up entirely of archive news and White House footage, The Reagan Show is a documentary that captures the pageantry, absurdity, and mastery of the made-for-TV politics of Ronald Reagan during his two terms in office as the 40th president of the US. This documentary shows how the former Hollywood actor redefined the look and feel of what it means to be in the highest office in the world, and also his rivalry with former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev during the Cold War era.
Okay, recording.
The Reagan administration will be remembered for excelling in public relations.
I think that he has captured the imagination of the American people because of his ability to communicate.
To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving the peace.
That's why New Hampshire needs John Sununu. Sununu.
Together, we'll make America great again.
I think appearance is very important, but it's also staging. It's how you stage the message.
Not me, honey.
It's a game.
That's it.
Super!
Well, if you'll pardon my stealing a film line, the force is with us.
You have stated flatly that you did not trade weapons for hostages.
What began as a strategic opening to Iran deteriorated in its implementation.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Happy New Year. Thank you. God bless you.
Cut.
Take that, Mr. Gorbachev.
So first of all, thanks for coming on. Very much welcome to the show. And I found this documentary to be incredibly an eye-opening insight into the superficial sort of role of the president in the U.S. And also, I suppose this documentary comes at a fitting time as we see many parallels between Trump and Reagan. And Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating sort of behind-the-scenes look. It's got that inbuilt nostalgia factor. I mean, Reagan himself kind of very much based his own persona on this kind of, you know, folksy, you know, bygone era charms, you know, referring back to his Hollywood career before he was a politician. And the film, because it's got that sort of, you know, the videotape and the sort of grainy look and everything, it's almost an inbuilt kind of nostalgia trip for anyone who remembers him from that time. I think as a film, because it sort of sticks so closely to the sort of found footage and you know, commentary from the time, it allows viewers to make parallels. So, you know, in the trailer, you see Reagan saying, "Make America great again," which obviously we have more modern connotations to today. But it doesn't give you that sort of perspective of people commenting back from now to then and sort of maybe shaping a bit more the narrative of how we went from this sort of, you know, maybe more substance-driven thing to a more sort of style and, you know, pageantry and performance thing. So I understand why they've done it, and within the confines of the structure and the style that they use, it works. But there's a wider story that maybe would allow for more kind of, you know, nuance and reflection on how we got to that point.
But perhaps the onus of the documentary and the perspective is on the rest of the audience to figure out what's happening using the archive. You're forced to be guided through it, really, because without generation.
No, for sure. I mean, you know, it's very much, you know, it puts there and it's asking you, so, you know, how does that resonate today? And obviously there's a huge amount. It's like, you know, now it's Reagan on steroids, you know, because it's not just old style Hollywood production, it's social media, which is a whole different world. but reflects, you know, it's gone from that and it's sort of metastasized into something even, even more pernicious, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I still think that there's an element there that what I would love to see, it's always, you know, you should never review the film that isn't made, but I would love to see him, how he went from actor to politician and used the media and the performance idea of that. It kind of starts, it's already fully formed. And we don't get a lot of analysis of how he became that, you know, ready-made image of a president.
So, Neil, if I could bring you in here, that was a good point that Lee made. How did you find this documentary?
Well, I agree with everything that Lee has just said. And I think for me as a historian, the problem with it is, and as you say, we shouldn't be criticising the documentary that wasn't made. But the reality is that if you focus on the image, and the image was very, very powerful politically. It was very, very effective politically, because that avuncular, friendly, warm, genial, round the log fire, all American kind of image that was being very successfully promoted was a cover for a range of policies which were really quite pernicious. I mean, massive union busting operation going on, a driving down of wages, massive cuts to the poor, huge shifts in terms of tax cuts for the rich. So the poor were being penalised with benefit cuts while the rich were getting richer through the tax cuts. And this massive increase in military spending.
That's a really interesting point, and I want to delve into that issue a bit later on in the show.
We were riding to the airport yesterday afternoon, and my mother was talking about in Arkansas that they were trying to pass a law to give 150 or pay people standing in their homes instead of going to the old folks' home. I made the comment, I said, I didn't think they should give anything. I thought we should take care of our own, you know. That's my feelings. My little one, I thought, was asleep in the back seat, and he raised up, and he said, Granny, that's why Ronald Reagan's the president. Stop all these giveaway programs.
Tell me, you had the experience, Mr. President, at one time of auditioning for film roles, and then when you ran for governor and president, you were auditioning in front of the public for office. Which is more difficult? What I have to say, this one is, you have to, well, you not only have to get the part, you have to write the script.
And Neil, there's a moment in the documentary also that's quite revealing, and we see the mask slip a bit when we see that Reagan admits that it was actually easier to be an actor than it is to be a president. Mm. And he also says that he couldn't imagine being a president without being an actor also. What do you think the film implies then about the suitability of his character for president?
Well, I think to a very large extent anyway, the American president is very often a figurehead who's controlled by other forces. I mean, I don't think Reagan was particularly right. I don't think he was particularly well informed. He's supposed to had a reputation of being very impatient of detail. I don't think he was a particularly quick thinker and so on. So I think we need to see him as, I mean, in a sense, the documentary's capturing this, isn't it? That he's the front man, he's the image, he's the folksy image, and the real hard policy is being decided by other people. And it was brutal policy, both domestically and in relation to what the US was doing internationally. So yes, you could say the image is a construct, and he's quite a shallow figure, but hey, does that make any difference to the Reagan project actually being driven through by this administration? Because it was being driven through very effectively.
And Lee, what did you make of how this character, Reagan, was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I mean, you know, I think with the best will in the world, even the biggest Ronald Reagan fans would not give him much credit as an actor. But he is uniquely suited for this sort of role because, as Neil says, he's got the best, you know, when he was a Hollywood actor, he never worked necessarily with the best filmmakers. Mm-hmm. When he's president, he's working with the very best people to stage and produce the theatre that's going on. And he's got that sort of, I mean, you know, I watched this very carefully. I don't think there's a moment where he's not smiling, or at least he never looks unhappy. Mm-hmm. He's always got that kind of, the lights are on, you know, I'm on stage, you know, and you saw him in the clip before. He ushers people towards the mic. He's so aware of, you know, his role within the production. So he succeeds so much better as a president than he ever did as an actor. Mm-hmm. And that's fascinating to me because you would think one has a lot bigger stakes and is a lot, you know, you need a much better, you know, person at the job to succeed as president. But actually, a sort of very average to mediocre actor mm-hmm. can, you know, whether you agree with the policies or not, be a very successful president in terms of putting his message across.
That is really interesting. And we do learn that actually he's been in 53 Hollywood movies or so.
It's a film about Reagan's years in office and looking at those years through the lens of PR, and in particular how he used PR and public relations to fight the Cold War. By making a film that let you watch Reagan go from his roles in Hollywood eventually to the presidency, you'd sort of see how his work in Hollywood informed his performance as a politician. So I found this archive called the White House Television Archive that was commissioned and overseen by the Reagan administration. 2,000 hours of footage documenting Reagan's time in office. So Reagan was the subject of the archive, but he was also kind of its author. And as I'm making this film, sometimes I like to joke that Reagan's actually, in some ways, deserves a co-director credit.
Neil, I just wanted to ask you to shed more political context on Reagan during the time. What was the political landscape like, and why was he elected?
I think there's a huge shift going on in the 1970s. The 1970s is a period of major crisis inside a lot of Western states, where there's a wave of radicalization, of union struggle, advances by social movements, and so on. And also internationally, US imperialism was on the back foot. In the 1970s, it suffered a series of very significant setbacks, the defeat in Vietnam, losing ground in Southern Africa, losing ground in Central Asia, losing ground in Central America as well, with the Nicaraguan Revolution at the end of the 1970s. And I think Reagan represents two things. He represents a kind of counterattack by the corporations and the rich inside America, against workers, against the poor, and against the social movements. And internationally, an attempt to reassert US imperial control over what is effectively an informal empire. They want to shore up US power at a time when the US economy is weakening, and that weakening of economic clout, which had been crucial to US power in the 50s and the 60s, to some degree you can compensate for that by substituting a more aggressive military stance. And I think that's what's happening under Reagan.
And in this documentary land that he was called a trigger-happy president, although he said he strived for peace, we saw sort of contradictions there.
Yes. No, that's absolutely right, because there's this massive, massive increase in arms expenditure, which brings it right up to the level that it was at the beginning of the Cold War in the early 1950s. And it creates a huge economic problem for the United States, a massive, massive budget deficit. I mean, all this stuff, you know, all this neoliberal stuff they're saying about how we need to control our budgets and we don't want big government, it's all nonsense. If you look at the military expenditure and the way it's being funded by borrowing, it has a crippling effect on the US economy in the long run. But what it does do is it breaks the back, this is the crucial thing, I think, of the Soviet Union. Because the Soviet Union, a much smaller economy and a failing economy, simply can't match these levels of arms expenditure. So you've got a second Cold War, which in a sense, Reagan wins by just upping the stakes to a level which the Soviets can't match.
That's really interesting. I want to pick up that point in the next part of the discussion, actually. And Lee, if I could ask you, did you see any similarities between Reagan and Trump? Because many critics are drawing many similarities between them and parallels.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that Trump would love to be, you know, as idolized as Reagan. And, you know, the whole Make America Great Again, which you hear Reagan say very early on in this documentary, you know, there's no, that's not a coincidence. He's trying to echo the sort of style. The difference is, and again, regardless if you agree with the policies, Reagan has a charm and a sort of, you know, acceptability to a large number of people. Trump obviously has a base. I mean, he won the election, even if he lost the popular vote. But it's kind of, you know, right-wing Republicanism with the mask off. It's the sort of the aggression and the kind of tit-for-tat stuff and the sort of intolerance is, which was, you know, largely covered by Reagan's, you know, kind of charm and sort of, you know, persona. That's all gone. And what's interesting now is it's like you don't even need that cover, it seems, at the moment to kind of succeed. And that's quite a sort of fairly terrifying development, I would say.
Indeed, and critics say that actually Reagan set the precedent for today's facts don't matter politics. And critics also say that Trump sort of coined this fake news sort of propaganda and techniques from the Reagan era. And we heard in the documentary, actually, that Reagan was aware of the frenzy he would cause with the media just to be able to dodge questions, so to speak. So do you think that there are similarities between the two?
Yeah, but we must be careful. I mean, fake news is a current term, but politicians have always lied, especially when they're defending a vested interest. They've always lied to the people, so we need to be quite careful. That's the old word really for fake news in a sense. But I think it is true. There's been a ramping up of that, and Reagan starts it, and it's now at an absolutely epidemic level. I think with Trump and actually with the Tory government in Britain as well, we've actually got to a point where lying has become fake news, if you like. Lying seems to have become pretty much systematic and institutionalized. So politicians are completely routinely saying the opposite to the public of what is actually happening behind the scenes. And it's there with Reagan, because everything Reagan is saying about, you know, this is a struggle between right and wrong, this is a crusade for freedom, Russia is the evil empire, all of this kind of stuff, this Cold War rhetoric that's being pumped out, is hiding, I mean, terrible atrocities and injustices which are being perpetrated by American imperialism.
I'll have to pause you there. We will pick up that more in the next part.
Gorbachev seems to be most confident that he can outperform Ronald Reagan. He's feeling comfortable, he's feeling good about the way things are going, and he thinks that he should be able to strut his stuff as well on the world stage.
It is Gorbachev who is very vocal with the press, talking, right, laughing, smiling. It is Mr. Reagan who is sitting back, speaking monosyllabically. Now, why isn't Mr. Reagan coming forward in the way that we've seen him in the past?
Gorbachev is trying to win through public opinion what he doesn't necessarily get at the negotiating table. If he can gain leverage against the United States through his propaganda efforts, then he can win something at the table.
And so the stage is set for Mr. Reagan and Gorbachev to report on their summit. With every indication, they will call it a success. But behind all the smiles and rhetoric, the question is whether they have really done something to make the world breathe easier.
So we see a lot of Gorbachev featuring in this documentary, and I think he's portrayed in a more charismatic light, and he seems to come across as a more bold leader than Reagan from the media clips that we've seen in this film. Lee, can I ask you, what did you make of their rivalry and how Gorbachev was portrayed?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the film is The Reagan Show, and it obviously concentrates on Reagan, but Gorbachev becomes a major player within the film because it kind of builds, you know, the Cold War as the overarching narrative for it. He comes across as incredibly charismatic and very intelligent, and I think what you see is there's a section where they show that actually the Russians or the Soviet Union hire an American PR firm to help with their own promotion and, you know, marketing effectively. So it's very clear that, I think the other thing we have to be really careful is, this is not just an American or a Western thing, this performance thing. Every country indulges in this. Every nation, you know, distorts the views that they need to sort of, you know, win the public opinion and stuff. It's not just the States, it's not just the West. And you see how the Soviet Union becomes very adept very quickly, and it's also got a very media-savvy figurehead who can basically go toe-to-toe with Ronald Reagan. And, you know, I think as much as Reagan obviously, you know, had a big part in play in the Cold War, I think you underestimate Gorbachev's role also doing that, whether it's only because, you know, the Soviet Union couldn't afford an arms race, but I think, you know, you could also look at it in a positive way and say, yes, there's also an impetus to try and break this kind of escalation that's going on.
That is a good point, actually. It does make you think, this documentary, about how intertwined the media and politics are. And Neil, I just wanted to quickly touch on how Star Wars was introduced in this documentary, and was seen as actually not existing, and it was a PR stunt to bring the Russians to the negotiating table. How accurate is this?
I think the Star Wars initiative was very, very real. I mean, I think this is why it's true to call it the Second Cold War, because if the US had developed a technology to shoot missiles down from space, the effect would have been that the mutually assured destruction, which had basically acted as a mutual deterrent, would suddenly have gone. The Russians were genuinely very, very frightened by this development and couldn't match it. They didn't have the technology and they didn't have the economic resources. And I think that that is a stick with which to beat Gorbachev. You see, I think Gorbachev was actually a more serious political player than Reagan. I think he really was driving it. I mean, what you see actually on the screen with Gorbachev is real. He's the young reformer who really is trying to transform the Soviet Union. And behind the scenes, what's actually happening is Reagan and his advisors are not giving much ground at all, particularly on Star Wars. And it's actually the Russians who make all of the concessions because they're so desperate.
Yes, we do see it, especially from this documentary, that the Americans are on the back foot. And so the final 20 seconds to you, Lee, as we're running out of time, would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I mean, it's a fascinating look at, you know, an era that really where video and, you know, the performance aspect came to power. You could argue that, you know, this is not, it didn't start with Reagan. You think of Kennedy and Nixon and the TV debates that people thought TV Kennedy won and radio thought Nixon won. But, it, you know, it's, it shows that it got ramped up in at this moment and it had a Hollywood actor. So it's kind of a perfect, you know, Hollywood movie. You know, the medium becomes the message, basically.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Chambiak.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN. Thank you.
the limelight. Firefighters are battling to contain a wildfire that erupted near Big Sur last week as the flames continue to engulf the dry California landscape and threaten historical sites, cabins, and ranches. The fire is one of dozens of wildfires burning in hot, dry conditions across western United States, including in Arizona and New Mexico. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Gabrielle Cannon, with contribution from the Associated Press. The piece is titled Big Sur Fire, Hundreds of Firefighters Battle Blaze Raging in California. Firefighters are battling to contain a wildfire that erupted near Big Sur in California last week as the flames continue to engulf the dry California landscape and threaten historical sites, cabins, and ranches. The fire is one of dozens of wildfires burning in hot, dry conditions across western United States, including in Arizona and New Mexico. In Monterey County, the so-called Willow Fire has burnt more than 2,400 acres of land since it broke out on Thursday evening, 17th of June. Roughly 450 firefighters faced the difficult task of trying to contain the large forest fire in the rugged coastal mountains south of Big Sur. The blaze remained at 0% containment as of Monday morning and forced the evacuation of a Buddhist monastery and nearby campground. The area is also home to endangered species and contains cultural sites that could be at risk if the wildfire continues to grow, and the Los Padres National Forest Resource Advisors have brought in biologists, botanists, and Chumash tribal members to aid in protecting sensitive areas. We have to take our time accessing these areas because we can't get the equipment in there, said Amanda Munsey, a public information officer with California Interagency Incident Management Team 11. The weather is also a big factor, she said, and it has been very hot for a number of days and very dry. Hundreds have been ordered to evacuate the mountainous area, including most of those at the Tassajara Mountain Zen Center, a historic Zen Buddhist monastery. Some Buddhist monks who are part of a trained fire crew stayed behind to assist in the firefight. The ZMC fire crew will remain in order to run the Dharma Rain, the Tassajara sprinkler system, and to prepare the monastery in case the fire reaches the valley, the center posted on its website on Sunday. The Tassajara has been working on special fire preparation project during the pandemic shutdown, and their fire crew has been in place and training for several months. Our water supplies are good and we are well prepared for this situation. The cause of the wildfire is still under investigation. The latest wildfire comes as the American West is gripped by a historic drought, as officials predict another record-breaking fire season. A heat wave has baked western United States, intensifying drought conditions and ignition risks much earlier in the year than normal. Already this year, 33 large wildfires have burnt more than 372,000 acres of land across 10 states, according to the National Interagency Fire Center. Right now in June, the dryness and the fuel conditions, it is what we would expect in August, says Munsey. It is alarming, but it is beyond our control, so we have prepared as best we can. Hope that that cooler weather expected with higher humidity across the San Francisco Bay Area in the coming days will help slow the flames. But there are concerns that winds along the ridges will continue to drive the wildfire and complicate containment efforts. But with so many wildfires already burning across western United States, resources have been strained. In Arizona, a blaze named the Backbone Fire that has burnt more than 32,750 acres of land after igniting last Wednesday from a lightning strike is also at 0% containment. Temperatures there have exceeded 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and thousands of residents have been evacuated northeast of Phoenix in the communities of Strawberry and Pine. There are major fires around Arizona and Utah and all over the western United States, Amanda Muncy, an information officer, said. That becomes problematic when trying to get resources to whatever fire you are on because they're already stretched so thin. Meanwhile, the mountainous city of Flagstaff, Arizona, was shrouded in smoke by another fire, dubbed the Raphael Fire, on Monday. If the fire continues its northeast push, hundreds of people in the College City, which lies about 2 hours north of Phoenix, Arizona, could be affected, according to officials. It's already been a tough wildfire season for Arizona, which has seen multiple blazes spark this summer. On Monday, two national forests in northern Arizona made rare announcements that they would close completely to visitors starting later this week because of concerns they won't have enough resources to respond to any future wildfires. And in New Mexico, lightning-sparked blazes have been scorching the southern part of the state, where a large portion of the Gila Wilderness remains closed. And fire officials are closely watching the Gila Cliff Dwellings National Monument.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.